Welcome to ContraPulse. This is Julie Valamont. Here we are with our second half of our interview with Pete Sutherland. Enjoy.
Thank you.
So what do you feel is the bare minimum that you need to provide for the dancers in terms of a structure to keep them happy so that you can have freedom after that?
Oh, all right. Well, of course, keep the beat. And so this is the broader topic, and this is more to do with bands than any one individual person. And that's why a band is a magical concoction. When it's working, it's undeniably greater than the sum of its parts, to be sort of classic about it. Mm-hmm. You know, and what does that mean? It means that everything is really integrated, and you're really relying on the other people to do their job so that you can do yours to the utmost. So in the beginning, in the modern era, it's who's keeping the beat? Well, traditionally, everybody's has some responsibility to the beat. And in the end, they do anyway. But if you have anything functioning as a drum, which in this decade and in this century is at least half the time is somebody doing feet. Mm-hmm. That's just like a watershed thing. It's just enormously freeing for us piano players, guitar players, and fiddler players for that.
Absolutely.
Matter. For everybody.
Yeah, it's the best.
Oh my God. Yeah, you could just like hit one note and the feet are going and everybody knows where you are, and as long as you can count to eight. But I think speaking as a piano player, you know, I immediately don't have to think like a boom chick person anymore. I can think like a pop piano player playing all kinds of syncopation. I can hit an organ patch or a synth patch and create something completely otherworldly. That would not have been okay if I was the only person providing rhythm. It would have put all the onus on the fiddle player or other melody players to play just like as rhythmically as they could, because what else would the dancers have to do? You couldn't just play a open fifth on your organ patch, and you know, we know there'd be nothing. You'd have nothing to give to the dancers, but there's the feet going, and I or you or any keyboard player would be able to immediately start painting in that realm. So that's huge. That's huge. And I, you know, I think the melody players realized a long time ago. I'm going to circle back to the Strutters here in a second, because I think we were kind of pioneers at figuring some of this out back in 1990 or whatever. Anyway, the fiddle players and melody players heretofore who played all the notes all the time, because that's what your training is, at least were faced with the challenge or opportunity, depending on which side of the coin you looked at, to play less notes, to leave space, to do a kind of a call and response with the rhythm section, to sketch the melody, decompose. These are all words that people that I've played with have used over the years, and you probably have some, you know, like anything that is less than 100% eighth notes.
Yeah.
Is what I'm talking about, and what we all have come to know in contemporary contra dance music as a thing. And it follows a minimal amount of adhesion to the structure of the dance, in that generally all those kind of activities are still within 2 bars, 4 bars, 8 bars, or something that goes with the figures of the dance. So, if the dancers are aware that this kind of shenanigans is happening on stage, they're doing right hand around while the fiddle player is doing a little sketch of a thing. And then when they go do a left hand back or a left hand with their neighbor, they're not looking for the fiddle player to finish that phrase anymore. They're expecting at this point that somebody else is going to be improvising the next two bars, right? Yeah. It's like, when did that happen? It started happening a couple of decades ago. And now it's like, no one thinks twice about that kind of thing. It's just so intuitive to have that kind of game playing going on up there.
Yeah. Trading, deconstructing the tune, taking half the notes are, starting the phrase and not finishing it. All those things.
Yeah. Rhythm section only.
Yep.
Riff, rhythm section riff. Foot break, drum break. Yeah. Solo.
When you started doing it, was anyone else doing that?
What I was aware of when the Strutters started was, I guess we had not, any of us heard anybody else in the contra dance world doing this. And again, this is like 31 years ago and counting here. No, 31 years ago that we first got together. And we kind of fell into this idea of deconstruction. And it was driven by the drums, really.
Mm-hmm.
And our drummer is a very outspoken guy, and he would say, "Play off the drums. This is not drums accompanying fiddle tunes. This is everybody working together.
Mm-hmm.
It's a new game that we're mm-hmm. playing here."
And the Strutters have such a wide variety of grooves, which is certainly a lot easier to do when you have drums.
Well. Yeah, I brought that in because of how the existence of drums has helped me develop a completely different approach to contra dance piano playing. And I only have two things that I really do on the piano. One is my singer-songwriter piano, like, the usual singer-songwriter piano, pretty basic, and then contra dance piano. And to get away from, the boom chick thing as an exclusive tool, which is, and there's no judgment that I'm making about the beauty of that either, because I love simple stuff. But I am very aware, as soon as there's drums, and we'll call feet drums for the moment, as soon as there's drums, I'm aware of how much freedom I now have
mm-hmm.
to paint. And I'm sure that somebody else is, if you're talking to anybody else that is in this kind of zone in a band as well and has the opportunity to experience this and practice their craft and develop it this way, I begin to think about what other instruments do. And I really began, even though I didn't get to play piano a lot in the Strutters because I was third in line behind two other great piano players, but occasionally I did, of how little I actually had to do with all that sound going on.
Yeah.
And it end up often being like salsa, where if you watch salsa players, that person is not even using their left hand most of the time. They're just doing these thing with their right hand, these little figures.
Like a Montuno kind of thing.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, exactly. And and so for me, it was horns. I just started thinking about horns. And there's a lot of wisdom to be had from top to bottom in that. Like, I think if you're going to play jazz fiddle, which I don't really, or swing fiddle, a lot of great fiddlers have attempted it and come up with their own language. But to me, we should all be listening to a tenor sax when we do that. Because they really developed the nuance. They developed the sound itself, and the moves, and the phrasing, and the tone, and what am I missing? Like all of that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And a good jazz fiddler, I feel like the best you can do is be an alto sax or a tenor sax. It's like, that's when you're at the top of your game.
That's what you should aspire to.
Yeah, that's what you should aspire to. Yeah, exactly. So anyway, the other end of the spectrum with that listening is, you know, sort of classic horn section hits and riffs and stuff. That's eminently transferable to postmodern contra dance piano. And in my opinion, and I feel like unconsciously, at least, I and a lot of other piano players who, again, who are suddenly experiencing this newfound freedom to be a creative outside the boomchick, kind of go there. It's probably intuitive. It's probably instinctive. It's just such, you know, a huge part of American music, right? Is the horn section, you know, big bands. And if we're not going to like ever have the experience up on the bandstand of a horn section, which a few bands, of course, have been able to engineer. So you know, like a way to make even less money at a contra dance, invite more people. But assuming you can write somebody can write a chart, you know, or some, you know, anyway, that's been done. It's been done. But generally most of us won't have that opportunity. Where was I going with that? You get to be, you know, the piano player suddenly gets to be that person. And that's, it's just totally fun. But to me, that's like, was a quantum leap when I realized that.
Yeah. Well, when you're working with an ensemble that big, one way to stay out of each other's way is each of you carve out your little musical space, and then you can really focus on that musical space that you're occupying.
Totally that. Yeah. Interlocking parts. Yeah. I think I was trying to say that earlier. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I'm curious to go on a little bit of a sidebar, but, you know, about like Malian music or the kind of 3/2 feel or those kind of rhythms that work well for contra dancing, surprisingly. You might not think they would, but because jigs are a thing that you can play around with. What was that experience like for you?
Pretty liberating. There is a lot of pretty fast 6/8 music out there in certainly Central African music in Shona and Biro music is, you know, and we definitely messed around with some of those tunes and those riffs, and slowing them down didn't always do the tunes themselves or the tradition any service at all. But it was a great exercise to try to work on that. The Ethiopian music that I referenced earlier that became part of the Clayfoot Strutters' early adoption. Some of that was in 6/8 and 9/8. 9/8 is not useful in contra, but at least it gave us sort of this idea of how we might go there. A lot of bands are uber familiar with, you know, the blues thing of, you know, the shuffle, the blues shuffle. And that's just almost like second nature for everybody.
Yep.
I personally, I get a little tired of that, but and big halftime groove, you know, if you've got a drummer and stuff, it's fun and dancers like it. But I feel like to do that all the time is kind of like, or just find that as your black hole that you're ever sliding into every time you play jigs is, I'm not personally satisfied with that kind of thing.
I kind of agree with you. I kind of got bored of the jigs being slinky jigs kind of trope.
Yeah, the slinky jig. Yeah, right. Yeah. It's like, how about just play bouncy jigs? How about let's just like have fun with some good old New England jigs? How about we play Dusty Bob and just like have fun with that? That you could not possibly turn into a slinky jig if your life depended on it.
This went to jigs have to be sexy. You know, that's such a funny question.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It just became, I don't know. We'd almost go off the record here, but, you know, everyone is guilty. You know, the Strutters played a lot of that kind of stuff. The posse has been very vocal with each other, which is part of our modus operandi. It's like, if somebody really has a feeling like we're talking about right now about something, they're not shy they say so. It's like, you know, tell me something you like about what we're doing right now. But also, if you don't like it, like, don't like clam up. Don't be, you know, Mr. Pouty Face stewing in your own corner about it. You know, it's just like, you're not serving anybody that way. You know, it's
that's
like,
right.
Do you actually hate what I'm doing right now? I'd rather know now.
Right. I mean, and
I don't want to find out later.
It is most noble. I think that's like an important part of the process, because I feel like a band is at its best when everybody's in the zone together. And so finding out what to say no to just paves the way for what to say yes to. And it helps you hone in on what your sound and is that it's going to be. So that's a fun way to justify being the, I don't like that, what you're doing right now kind of person.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, I've read enough of the Nonviolent Communication Manual to have figured out, at least, you know, how to not be, you know, really antagonistic about it. But, you know, I really need you to play the bass, you know, the chord tone, the tonic. I need you to play the tonic so that I kind of like can work out a part on top of it that will feel like we're actually going to serve the dance, something like that. No. Or, you know, I don't really hear... Myself, I don't really, that's an interesting chord you're playing there, but I don't really hear, how about, anyway.
These are useful skills as a producer as well, you know, when you're in the studio with people and you're trying to tactfully guide them in a certain direction.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we could have another hour and a half on peace adventures and group therapy. With groups,
good.
Right. I only had one group do a retreat with me and then break up out of those 80 projects. So,
not bad.
That's not too bad. I only got fired once, and I only had that happen once, and mostly things have been really pretty. They were pretty good, but So. I have learned more about that allowed me to learn more about communication, really, that experience of working with other bands and having to coax, you know, communication out of people that were not really effectively communicating, you know, people that were patently passive aggressive or, you know, just real textbook kind of stuff.
I mean, you have to set up like a safe musical space where ideas, like you'll yes and each other's ideas, and people can feel comfortable bringing up ideas so that then when you do want to say no to an idea, that's an okay part of the process. You know, like you can't just say you don't like things unless there's this bigger creative safety process there where you trust each other.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it's not to say that we bat 1,000 in the posse or that any group bats 1,000. I'm sure that, you know, you could line up about 6 people in a Zoom call. That would be an interesting sort of Zoom call, is just hone in on one particular topic. Maybe you could engineer that in your current life and be like a workshop at a festival or something.
Like, yeah, those like panels where they have 6 people on stage, each, you know, taking the turns talking about one topic.
Yeah. Like, here's what's a couple of the most effective tools that you have honed for moving a conversation through a tough spot, through a sticky spot about group process to get through it and feel like the wheels are moving again. Because we've all been there, right? We've all been there.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you.
started doing all this stuff with the Clayfoot Strutters, how did people react to it? Like, I'm kind of curious, like, what the context was of what you were doing at the time, and was it kind of new and exciting? Was it like, oh, we've had other crazy bands like this before? Did you feel like you were doing anything scandalous, or was it just fun, or?
Well, none of us will ever forget. let's see. I guess I can say where it was, right? It was the DEFA, the Down East Folk Festival in Portland, or wherever it was being held. It was one of the early festivals that we got hired at. I think George Marshall was there with us. Like, again, he was kind of our angel. He got us hired in various places. He really, truly believed in what we were doing. But at that time, there was almost zero bands with drums.
Mm-hmm.
And feet were not even a really big thing yet, I don't think, unless you were literally just playing Quebecois music. So before that, all steamrolled. So we basically had no firewall. We were just like, or force field or whatever. We were just rocketing into, you know, the contra dance world, unapologetically drums, you know, front and center, and this big sound. And the reason that we were probably able to get our foot in a number of doors right away was just who we were as well-known people, you know. So there's Jeremiah. Mm-hmm. It was me. There was pretty soon Mark Roberts, Peter Davis, you know, our various bass players and other guitar players that came and went. So various people, and so that's the way to get a gig. You know, it's like, oh, Jeremiah, cool, love him. So get the gig. It was pretty early on that we. That George, I think, got us this gig at DEFA. Should this be off the record, or is it? It's a long time ago.
That's,
and we've played
you.
There since.
We can decide.
And
afterwards.
The Posse is. Yeah, the Posse played there. So, you know, I wasn't blacklisted forever myself. There was a famous incident when the Posse played there with a horrible, you know, ear destroying feedback, but that was its own adventure. Oh. But what happened when the Strutters went there was, we played our first set on Friday, like a welcome contra kind of thing in the afternoon. And then there was the potluck supper and stuff. And so everybody's like going around, milling around. We kind of did that band thing where we went out to get some Chinese food and came back. And there was apparently a very heated argument going on amongst the organizers, not all of whom had necessarily entirely grokked what the Strutters were or what they sounded like. And they were not happy. They were not happy. It just wasn't their cup of tea, as it were. And George, in his inimitable, smiling George Marshall way, came and broke this news to us. It's like, well, I'm having this, you can imagine George Marshall doing this. Mm-hmm. It's no smile, never leaves his face ever, even in the face of impending doom. It's just awesome. We used to say, if there's a nuclear war, you definitely want to be somewhere within about 50 yards of George.
Absolutely.
Because he'll tell you what bus to get on. Exactly when it leaves, to get the hell out of there. So anyway, he came up to us now and said, well, in smiling, you know, there's some discussion happening. And I just wanted to let you know, before you retake the stage at 8 o'clock, you know, and so I guess they worked it out because we played the weekend, but that's just kind of like an anecdotal thing. I was not aware of necessarily a lot more of that going on. I'd be basically, if somebody had heard us and wanted to hire us, they kind of already had figured out how to negotiate with their team, you know, any questions that might be had. And if there was one or two dissenting voices, well, I guess it's like the old consensus building kind of thing or something.
Mm-hmm.
And that coupled with the fact that we were expensive because we were big, you know, I mean, we, there were a lot of places we never played. So, and that's fine. It's totally fine.
Yeah. And this was, I'm sure, some years ago. But, you know, the main, like the DEFA is in Maine, and it's a wonderful, wonderful dance community there. But it feels it feels like a more local community to me. And I don't know about back then, but at least my experience is in it now where, you know, people, it's wonderful because you can go to a dance and you don't really care who's playing because you just want to see your friends, and the bands are always great and they're made up of very local people. And it's a more like kind of that regular contra sound of like a bunch of people playing tunes together and having fun. So I can imagine a band like the Clayfoot Strutters where there's drums and not tunes and loud things and crazy grooves and stuff would be quite the surprise.
Yeah, this was back when this is like, well, it was no later than about 1994, 1993, might have been earlier. So that's a long time ago. And if you kind of cast your brain down chronology of some of the other bands that came along doing various, you know, edgy and avant-garde things, you know, not many of them were in existence, right, in 1993. So this was when Wild Asparagus, which has been around for like centuries, was still considered pretty avant-garde.
Yeah.
You know.
Was Nightingale a thing? Like,
Nightingale was not quite. It was just forming in the early 90s, just locally in Montpelier, and they weren't well known at all at that time. That was, and they of course launched the golden age of trios. You know, with making more sound than any three people could be thought to make, and many bands owe so much to that group. Like pretty much every trio.
Oh, absolutely.
Owes a lot to Nightingale.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, you know, that's, they deserve their own mega chapter in this book, for sure. But, you know, everybody now gets to have their own experience that we're talking about, if they change one or more component of the expected, you know, playing for contra dances thing, and they happen to find themselves in a setting where that was not really part of the, how to put this, you know, it's not why you got hired. You didn't get hired for being, you know, you got hired for being like creative, but maybe not that creative, or innovative, but maybe like not that innovative or something. and it still exists. I mean, you could go to a thing like Ralph Page, an amazing weekend. You know, it's not about edgy postmodern contra dance music. It's about, you know, honoring the amazing, solid four on the floor contra dance music and calling and repertoire traditions and style. You know, the whole style and everything is like, that's why people go there. And the Posse got hired there like several years back, courtesy of a couple of our friendly neighborhood callers. And we were allowed to be what they considered the, you know, in their hiring thing, they had the trad band, and then of the two guest bands, they had the trad band and they had the sort of not quite so trad band, of course, not so trad band, but even there, you know, we were probably like a little further to the left than most non-trad bands were. And we worked really hard at tradding ourselves up for that. You know, we like learned a bunch of, and, you know, I just wanted to make sure that my bandmates, you know, weren't going to like embarrass me by not knowing the chords to Halls of Victory or something like that.
Right.
So we worked hard on it, and then we, and went down there, and I'm very lucky because, my partner, Oliver Scanlon, who's been playing with me since he was 10, came up through the ranks of this after school group that I was teaching very trad material, like Canterbury Orchestra material and stuff. So he actually knew all those tunes. That helped a lot. But I guess we must have, you know, like blown our cover numerous times because there were anecdotes from the floor reported to us sort of afterwards. Like there was somebody out there dancing who said to his partner, if I wanted to hear this kind of music, I would go to a Bernie Sanders rally.
That's a great compliment.
Well, that's what we thought. And we've used that line ever since.
Ah, you guys are socialists.
Yeah.
Counter-socialists.
We'll say that at a rehearsal sometimes. If I wanted to hear that chord, I'd go to a Bernie Sanders rally. Yeah. Yeah. Thanks to the audience for all our best lines, really.
Yeah, they enlighten us so many ways.
Right. Yeah. So there's that thing about like the line. Where is the line? And it's every gig, of course, as you well know, is potentially, unless you do the same kind of gig over and over, right? Unless you're on like an endless contra dance tour and you just play basically the same kind of evening for this crowd, and it's kind of cookie cutter in a way. And then you get to just be yourself and you don't have to worry about the line having moved. But if you're like one of the bands that is, you know, like taking every sort of opportunity for gigs, including concerts, and then playing like a wedding for beginners and then playing a festival with some super hot dancers and then playing the next night, you're playing, you know, where half the crowd is like walk-ins and the tempos are different and or your color is like got a completely different languaging going on, you know, then the center line just is always moving. It's always moving. Mm-hmm. In terms of what you can do. I don't mind that personally, but
it's an interesting question. Like you're telling the anecdote about Ralph Page is like, what is traditional in that sense? Is it a question of what tunes you're playing? Is it a question of, are you playing tunes or not? Is it instrumentation? Is it groove? Is it weird chords? Yeah. You know, is it arrangements? And are there arrangements and how weird are those arrangements? I feel like we could make, instead of an X, Y axis, you could have like 8 different axes and have sliders along each of them.
Yeah.
Because I think of Pete Spazi as a more traditional band than the Clayfoot Strutters, partly because of your instrumentation, you know, and because you do play more tunes per evening. But then there's a lot of things that obviously people don't consider traditional.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. A little bit apples and oranges just because of the dynamics of the band and the makeup and the opportunities for sharing the lead and the huge rhythm section. I mean, in the Strutters, I sometimes was the fiddler backed up by 5 other people.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, which is just kind of amazing.
The groove is the tune in a way, you know,
like
you're dancing to the groove, to the Clayfoot Strutters.
Yeah. The groove is the experience. The fiddle is almost just like frosting on top in a way. But I think the posse owes a lot to the Strutters. The posse owes a lot to Metamora, my concert band. You know, we basically, because of me being the through line, I suppose, I brought like all my lives to bear on that. And like all trios, again, we owe a lot to the founders of the golden age of trios that we're in now, Nightingale. And in terms of, you know, this amazing sonic range and groove division of labor, you know, we don't have an accordion, but other than that, we kind of do what a lot of other trios do. I don't know. I'm missing some other kind of like elements to kind of talking about this right now, but I feel like choice of material is still a huge piece that should give everybody heart. You know, if you're willing to keep looking for yet another interesting melodic idea out there, whether you're going to write it or you're going to find it somewhere else, it births an entire new opportunity. You know, mm-hmm. Early on, I had this tune that was one of my mandolin students at one time gave me. It was a Bollywood tune. It's this, you know, it's not contra dance music, but it is, mm-hmm. right? And that's the mindset that we now all find ourselves in, right? If we're doing the experimental thing, it's like we instantly know that that's not a contra dance tune, and we instantly recognize that it could be.
Right. It's catchable.
That's where
it's catchy. It's phrased. You know.
It's totally 32 bars, or possibly it just needs a little bit of sanding in order to be
right.
32 bars.
Yeah. Is it catchy? Is it phrased? Is it the right length? And can it go at the proper tempo, which to me ruins a lot of good tunes.
Oh, yeah.
I discovered that my favorite tempo is about 94. So I would hear all these tunes and fall in love with them on various albums, be like, oh, that goes at 94. Yeah. And it's that awkward thing where you can't double time it or slow it down. It's just right in between.
Yeah.
And it just doesn't work.
Right. Well, you could be like the Horseflies and just say, like, it's my way or the highway. We're going right. to play at 94 and just screw you. Just have fun. That's where we're at.
Yeah.
But most people can't get away with that. So you're right.
I mean, the Strutters have a reputation for being a little bit on the slower / groovier side.
We love it. And so does the Posse now. I mean, if we had our druthers, we'd be around 100, I think, or 104 or something like that. And it just galls me that, you know, that a lot of people think if it's any slower than 116, it's crap. So, you know, it's like, how about you just like take a chill pill and enjoy being in your body with your partner, with your neighbors, and not like trying to catch a subway here.
Yeah. Shake your hips a little bit. I mean, the different grooves make it easier to go slow because you have something to do with your body in that dead space when you're not moving.
Yeah.
I think some people love it and some people it's not their jam. I think some people really love the feeling of momentum in contra dancing where you're moving forward and progressing and constantly moving, and maybe the slow tempos don't allow that for them.
Yeah.
But then they can go dance to something else, right?
they can totally. Yeah, they can totally. I don't know. What's the slowest that you feel like you've ever gotten away with playing?
Oh, wow. Probably not much less than 100 for me.
Yeah. Right. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Same. I think if it goes below there, somebody's going to call you out. Somebody is. Dancers or the caller, you know, but the callers, it's, you know, bless their hearts. They're only trying to kind of like keep everybody connected and happy. So it's not like they're birthing their own, you know, sense of morality about the whole thing. They're just like, you know, being your firewall against some dancers that are going to like rush the stage in a fit of pique because you're going too slow and they can't deal with it. That's how I read it anyway. Yeah. So they become sort of proactive about policing your tempos. It's taken me a long time to kind of like adopt that attitude. In the beginning, I was like, the heck with you. We're going to play at the tempo there. I know how to play contra dance music. I've been doing it since 1973. you know, I can feel 112, 114, 116, 118. I feel them in my bones. And I do.
Yeah.
I just might not want to play 116 at the moment. This tune might just like sound like crap at 116. It might really need to be at 108 or 104. And can we just like be, can you allow us to just have that power to make our own decision about this musical experience for dancing? That's a big topic too, isn't it? Really? Oh my God. Who has the power? Where is the balance of power?
Right. I mean, it's a consensus ultimately. Like, if
Yeah.
any one of us, the dancers, the caller, or the musicians, go too far in any direction, we'll get pulled back to the center like a rubber band, you know, because it won't work for the
Yep.
dancers, or you won't get hired, you know. But there is a kind of thing of like, sometimes the dancers drive what bands have to be, and vice versa, you know. And now as a band, you're trying to tell the dancers how to dance in a way, musically, you know.
Yeah,
Groove
exactly.
and tempo.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, and as you said, you know, there's well, you didn't say it this way, but we used to say it. There's a lot for the lower chakra in all these grooves. So we used to say, you know, dance with your lower body as much as your upper body.
Yeah.
When this if this music is moving you at all, the late Dave Grant, our bass player on the Strutters, would have put it much less succinctly. Yeah, anyway.
So, what's your favorite music to dance to?
To contradance to?
Yeah, I mean, there's so many different kinds of dance music out there, and you've made so many different kinds of it. What do you like?
Yeah.
Like, do you make the music that you would like to dance to? Or do you make the
I
music
make
that you like
yeah.
to make?
I always want to dance to the band that I'm in for sure. It doesn't mean it's my favorite, but it's definitely we're trying to make the music that we personally would love to dance to. Yeah, so for sure.
It's a great cruelty
Like,
that
why not?
contradance musicians never get to dance to themselves on the dance floor. You can dance to a recording of yourself
Exactly.
at home, but it's never the same experience.
Yeah, well, the closest I came was in the last year or two of the Strutters, three maybe. We imported Oliver into the band and did some gigs with double fiddles, and then one or another of us got to step off stage and dance.
Oh,
And
fun.
he, you know, he does play enough. He adopted kind of the Strutter aesthetic about where the fiddle is, and you know, because he had been dancing to the Strutter since he was a little boy, and so you know, he kind of he
Yeah.
grokked it. So, you know, I could go on the floor and it sounded exactly like the Strutters. So that was one opportunity for sure. But that didn't happen hardly ever.
It's kind of like cooking for other people, and you never get to taste what you're cooking, except when maybe once in a while when it's like cold leftovers, you could have a bite and see how it was, but you never get to taste it right when it's fresh out of the oven. You
Yeah.
just have to look at everybody's
Right. Yeah.
faces and try to guess what it's like and use your
Yeah.
years of experience.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe, yeah. Right. Even less so in this experience with not getting to dance out there. But yeah, we lament that a lot, you know, because we all dance in our band, we all dance. So me not as much anymore. I just got like old guy issues, but I have danced a lot and so I always imagine what it would feel like, which also helps in being a reality check on some of my more adventurous moves that I might make. Is like, could I dance to that? You know, we have more conservative friends that we also kind of like, we've adopted some of their philosophies, some of their lines. So there's one fellow who said, you're not here to serve yourself, you're here to serve the dancers. And he said it with an accent, basically because he's from a foreign country. So I don't want to go any closer to that. But so that's another one of, you know, every band that it's got to chew up the miles, you know, in the van some way, and one of the ways is you come up with your entire lingo and folklore, and so that's entered posse folklore as well. You're not here to serve yourself; you're here to serve the dancers. So we can—that's shorthand for saying, I think, you know, you have at least consider that you're going a little too far out right now.
Curious to hear, it's such a big question. Again, I don't know how to ask it, but just like thinking about tradition, it seems like you've spent a lot of your career kind of dancing with tradition in a way where you're like learning from it and informed by it and then creating new traditions and then dancing around tradition and subverting tradition and passing on tradition and coming at it from so many different angles. Like, you seem like you understand tradition, but you're not a traditionalist in a way.
Thank you. Well, I guess that's the place to end up, right? I was never going to be either one or the other. And it's, you know, I referred earlier to having been through, you know, not growing up with this music at all. So it was just like a really like discovering a lost planet when I did get there. Coming out of my rock and roll years, realizing that I had a pretty good ear, listening to a lot of kind of neo folk rock kind of stuff, you know, just like a lot of the ingredients were kind of boiling around, and that's just like never left me at all, even when I set out to learn old time music, which is kind of my first language on the fiddle, still before I, you know, even attempted to play some more technical stuff, you know, from the Irish side or Scottish or whatever. I kind of got sucked into the amazing groove world of old time music, and was playing banjo too and all of that. But even there, you know, in like really apprenticing myself resolutely to certain players and certain traditions from the Upper South and stuff, I still was not a purist. I just could not be a purist. And I'm just mentioning that because I think that's kind of emblematic of my life in a way. It's like there are some of my fellow aficionados of old time music, which is a small, extremely loyal and devout community, many of whom really don't like any other kinds of music at all. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like opera or heavy metal or something like that. There are certain communities that's like, that's it. I don't need any other music. Thank you very much. Bluegrass, maybe, for some people. I've never been any of those. And so some of my fellow old-time players and devotees where I'm super aware that they didn't consider me very old-time, you know, which in the beginning was like really disheartening and, I don't know, you know, dismaying in a way. It's like, what? I'm trying so hard. I'm wearing out these friggin' tapes, these cassette tapes, you know, working on the Boeing and everything else. What do you mean? What do you mean I don't sound old time? And then I went through that whole period where it was like, you know, I'll never find my voice, because I was also trying to learn Irish tunes or, you know, Quebecois tunes, or, and I was still writing songs, and I was like doing all this stuff. And it just seemed to be counterproductive to finding my own way through. And now I realize, of course, long story short, that's been the gift in my life, is to not actually give up and not say, well, that was wrong. I should just do one thing. I should just follow one tradition. I should just play one instrument. I should just, you know, be the best traditional New England fiddle player I could be. Or I should just apprentice myself to Bob McQuillan and just learn everything he ever did. Or, you know, you name it, the list could go on. But I didn't do that. Mm-hmm. I just didn't do that. Because I like it all too much.
How have you seen the contra dance scene changing? Like, do you have any thoughts about what, I mean, besides this weird hiatus that we're all on because of COVID, like, do you have any thoughts about where it's headed in the future, or opinions about where you might like to see it head or anything like that?
Yeah, we kind of just have to take COVID out of the equation, right? And the hiatus out of the equation, because like, oh my Lord, when it comes back, whenever that is, it's just going to be so much pent up energy that, you know, we just can't even imagine. But if it had been allowed to continue through, might be a better sort of postulate for this question. You know, where is it going? Where was it going? Where will it be going after the blip, the great blip? I feel like you know, there'll always be more bands, either pick up bands of convenience, supergroups that rise and fall quickly, attempts at, you know, a band for the long haul. And among those bands that are real strong adherents to one tradition or another. One thing that was certainly happening will continue to happen, and it's partly just economically driven, is trios and duets. 'Cause mm-hmm. money, right?
Especially when travel's involved, if you have to fly somewhere, drive somewhere, long distances.
Yeah, holy crap. And you know as well as I, there's like a dance weekend. They're not really very interested in hearing very much about your quartet or your quintet. And anyway, I mean, if they already love you, or if you have a caller in the group, you know, or sound person in the group or something like that, then maybe we'll talk. But duo and trio, you know, that's kind of like, it's about it. So that's a big change. And in terms of the sound that you get out of that, well, it's a good thing that trios have been sort of a evolving and an enriching sort of experience to apprentice yourself to and to experience the limits of and to add your own language to post Nightingale, post, you know, other trios. And you could speak to the duo thing, I'm sure. I've never been in a kind of like a more contemporary duo thing. But obviously there's a number of really notable groups like yourselves and Perpetual Motion and Notorious and, you know, people that just make mm-hmm. a lot of sound mm-hmm. For two people. Maybe that's the most identifiable thing that's happening right now. How much sound can three people make? How much sound can two people make? And given some kind of answer to that, where are you going? What kind of elements are you going to make a part of your sound that are already common, and what ones that are maybe not so common that you can try out? Which could be a new instrument, could be new repertoire that has nothing to do with any pre-existing sense of contra dance music that comes from before,
like microtonal. Maybe that's the only place we have
microtonal. Who's microtonal done that stuff? Yeah, like you with your Moog synthesizer there or whatever that you pulled out.
Or how about things not at a 12 note scale? Like how about gamelan? Things that aren't even tuned to A440 with end all pickup bands.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, I mean, well, I don't think people have really scratched the surface, really, if you're able to do, you know, kind of that kind of thinking. But, you know, even on a milder level, just like getting the melodica really identified as being not just this. It's not like our version of a bombard. It's not like just make everybody go, woohoo, you know, bombard to me. It's great. It's a great tradition. But if that's not a cheap trick, I don't know what is. That's really what it is. It's like it's bringing out like a dog and squeezing it so hard that it barks into the microphone. That's a cheap trick.
It's novelty.
Like, here's my dog. Okay, let's put that dog away in its little crate again, and maybe we'll pull it out in the second set, and it'll bark again.
And so you'd like the melodica to be viewed as a traditional instrument and not just a novelty instrument.
You're totally working really hard at that. Well, it's not tonally that weird. It's, you know, it's a good toned, a professional model melodica is like an accordion on just like one stop, a simple stop.
Absolutely.
Or a concertina or something like that.
I have a Hohner melodica. Has the same metal reeds in it that they put in Hohner accordions, you know?
Exactly. Or like a large harmonica or something like that.
Yeah.
Right. So that's one thing. You know, banjo, five string banjo playing along in sort of Celtic repertoire. It's kind of novel. The keyboard, back to the keyboard. You know, using the organ stop or the synth stop, you know, I mean, there are still people that think that that's like too weird for words, but, you know, I am just one of those people that are like, you know, I think this is a great idea. And, that's a way that I am going to expand our palette when the feet are going or some rhythmic element's going and just check it out here. Vocals. Oh yeah, we have worked out quite a few things with vocals on them. We're not the only ones, but I think we're as well known for it as anybody. And it's not just the, you know, our covers of Light My Fire and George Harrison and things like that, you know, that we'll pull out. It's Turlute, you know, French Canadian Turlute,
singing
along with the tune.
Yeah.
Yeah, mouth singing. Yeah, and all with great respect for when the caller's done their thing, you know. So it's never appears before about the ninth time through the dance, when hopefully the caller's done having to be on the mic and then we kind of take over there. So I would not be surprised if more and more groups kind of used that element as well. That's a few.
Yeah.
It's just maybe the tempo thing will change too. Maybe. Maybe people will be into dancing slower.
I had this fantasy for a while. Once I discovered that I really like 94 beats per minute is my favorite tempo, and I wanted to do all my techno conchas at 94. I really wanted to, like, yeah, some late night party, get a bunch of friends and invent a way of concha dancing that slow. Because you'd have to add new moves and new flourishes, yeah, and you'd have to move differently in order to even make that possible. You know, it's,
yeah,
something we've joked about totally for years and years and never done it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think if people are willing to kind of like stay in the zone of how they recreate movement with any new kind of backbeat or any new, you know what I mean, at normal, quote, normal contra tempos, like techno contra, people probably subconsciously and maybe later consciously actually change their dancing, right?
Mm-hmm.
It could be self-fulfilling prophecy that people are actually, you know, the kind of people that would go to a techno contra are people that are already dancing that way. They're already going to move their body differently. They're already going to be using their lower body in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
Than a lot of other people who don't techno contra. So, but the tempo thing is, I think, is a bigger acid test, maybe. So I think you hit the nail on the head there.
Yeah, and I can see people, they're, you know, the same dancers who go to the regular dance with a regular band come to a techno contra and they start moving differently, you know, and it's really fun. Just, yeah, like people dance differently to Pete's Posse. You take the same people and put them in front of the Clayfoot Strutters, they're going to move differently. And that's, yeah, really fun.
We're giving you a different information to dance to. There was a, this is apropos of nothing. It was years ago at our fiddle camp, Northeast Heritage, when Sandy McIntyre, the great old traditional Cape Breton fiddler, was on staff. And we had a dance every night where different people on the staff played. And not all of them played for dances regularly. So it was just such a great sort of potluck of stuff. And it still happens. You know, like people just play their repertoire and people get to dance to it. And he started playing, you know, not a march, but he played, you know, it's like an MSR, March Strasbourg Real Set. So he, somebody cued him in that the march wasn't going to work. So he started writing with a couple of stress bays at the beginning of the contra set.
Interesting.
And, you know, interesting is not the word for it. So we're just doing a simple, like, forward and back. David Kaner was calling the affable David Kaner in his prime. You know, it's like, you know, just going to keep going. But we, you know, it's like you either could dance sort of half time or sort of double times, like you were saying before, but nothing in between. And it had no relationship to the narrow range of contra dance tempos. So we all ended up dancing kind of double time. So like as you go, wow, forward and back, you know, one, two, three, four, and back, two, three, four. This was going like dun, dun, da, dee, dee, dun, da, dee, dun, da, dee, da, dun. And we all felt like we were in like some kind of cartoon.
Like you've been sped up or something.
I don't know what Sandy McIntyre was thinking, looking out, and everyone was like, hardly could stand up because they're doubled over laughing. like we can't believe we're doing this. That's definitely one of the high points.
That's amazing.
It was totally amazing. It was everybody, you just like talk about it. If you were there, you just started talking about it, and then you just can't talk. You're laughing so hard. You can picture it, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
I mean, it's fun to mess with the dancers a little bit. You know, maybe that wasn't totally intentional, but... You know, I know bands who will, yeah, like play a waltz and then switch to a polka in the middle. You know, it's like,
oh, yeah, yeah,
you're ruining somebody's day, but it's also kind of fun, you know.
Yeah.
All that kind of stuff, that sort of mayhem, yeah, thing.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. We were going to, we've never pulled this one off, but we were going to pull this on some collar. And just start playing something in 7/8 and just wow. see how long it took for everything to completely fall apart. Not long, I imagine.
Yeah, that, oh my gosh, that'd be so hard. I mean, I've had callers not be able to hear the phrasing in a tune and think that we were off when we weren't. You know, that happens sometimes. Yeah, exactly. And then that ultimately is on us. You know, then maybe the tune isn't a great dance tune or needs to be accompanied differently or phrased differently or something. But
exactly. That is, yeah, that's a tough one. And you're right. It's, we can whine and we can argue, but it's on us. You know, there's a lot of tunes that would work and we should just kind of like take a step back and reevaluate. That's why old time music doesn't always work, because it's it can be one chord. Best tune in the world, one chord, right?
Yep.
You know.
So you don't have Irish the chords to give that you that phrasing. And some old time tunes, their phrasing is not in the like 4-bar chunks that we're used to.
Yeah. I would never do that. You know, Will Mentor and I right now are he's up here in Burlington when he's working. He's an art professor at St. Mike's College in Colchester. And he's been kind of stuck here. And so we go for nice masked walks and stuff. And we've ended up having this long running conversation about, wouldn't it be great to put together an entire evening of dance and music repertoire that dancing was all contra dance repertoire. It was a contra dance evening, no squares. And the entire musical repertoire was from various corners of the old time music world, the Appalachian and Midwestern and Deep South and stuff. And really go deep. We really go deep about why does this sounding tune work for this kind of feel of dance. So we draw the lines really tightly and then we just like have a lot of conversation. And we're like almost halfway through a potential program that we actually, end of pandemic and we're all still alive, we want to actually try out.
That's really interesting.
Because I don't think it's ever been done. Because, you know, there's old time and there's old time. There's some where just like, you know, a real shit kicking A modal tune that doesn't have any chords is perfect. Mm-hmm. It's no different than playing an Irish tune that is just like hell for leather. And there's other ones where you really need to hear the phrasing much better. There's some that are kind of like the more elegant, you know, cotillion kind of old time tunes. There's some that are, you know, marchy, or some that are, Civil War, the B part goes into the minor kind of, you know, mournful stuff. And there's good old Galax tunes that are, you know, happy and, you know, there's just all different old time, and they're bluesy, raggy. There's rags. Mm-hmm. You know? There's Midwestern tunes that are very much right off the boat, you know, and sound a lot like, you know, Le Voyageurs or something, you know. But,
so the devil's advocate in me would say, like, why would you take all these beautiful kinds of old time and want to try to contra dance to them? But I think what's interesting is, by pairing them up to dances, and you're like distilling some of the feels from each of these traditions and kind of comparing them to each other in that way. And that's interesting.
Yeah. It's a wild thesis, but you know, when I first visited Bloomington, Indiana in 1980, the dance was already 10 years old. The strongest musical tradition there on the part of people that were playing the dance was old time.
Absolutely.
And that's pretty much what you always heard. Occasionally, Miles Crasson, who lived there, played some Irish music or something. By the time I got there, it was anything. You know, there's some amazing players, various traditions. But so I was doing the contra dancing that I first experienced in Bloomington was all to old time music. And they had never known anything else. And those dancers, more importantly, those dancers being new to the whole idea of contra dancing out there in the hinterlands, never having been even set foot in New England, they didn't know any better. Mm-hmm. They're like, this is a contra dance. This is the music. Mm-hmm. Hello. You know, what's the big deal? So And the tempos were, yeah, a little fast. A little fast. They were up there at 120, 122. And I just mean you kept your feet a little closer to the floor and not so many flourishes, but it totally worked.
I mean, in a sense, that's tradition, right? It's like sort of like you play whatever instruments you have around. You play whatever music you happen to have in your community and you make a dance out of it. And that's a tradition in its own way, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah. The other end of the scale, or those many ends of the scale, is my ex-wife did a summer in Labrador, Canada, and tried to organize a little community there. And they, you know, they had had them. So there was one old timer that called one dance, one quadrille, or it was maybe a piece of a Lancers, like there were two figures, you know, and people would then sit down and, you know, stuff themselves on some store-bought cookies or something. And then the accordion player played, the fiddler said all died out. It was just an accordion. And then about an hour later, somebody said, let's dance. And what do you think they did? The same dance with the same tune.
You do what
that's
you know.
A party.
Yep.
That's a party right there.
I could dance the Virginia Reel all night and be totally happy, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Or could you do it to the same tune, and could you do it every party that you went to and never do anything else? Or would you feel like it was Groundhog Day? That's the question.
Well, right. And then the question is, what are you just doing it at weddings and parties once in a while? Or, you know, if you're like a weekly urban dancer and your dance is like your form of entertainment, you want something more than that, right?
Yeah.
Then right. If you're just like exactly. Blowing off steam after a day of work or after your wedding with your friends and, you know, you just want to party together. Yeah. It's a little bit of a different.
Exactly. Well, In my cynical youth, you know, I hopefully I'm shedding most of it as I get old here. It's like I would say, you know, it's all these people with desk jobs that really are just so frustrated, and also they're working at, you know, they're programming or whatever. So they are bringing all of that energy to contra dance, evening contra dance situation, and they want, you know, variety, and they want like really sciencey sort of, you know, what's the latest cool moves. You know, they don't want any dance to like evoke another dance. And I suppose the music maybe was part of their thinking, but mostly it was about the choreography and the collars really kind of like took it on the chin, because that made the collars have to really stay up late, like trying to learn more and more and more repertoire, you know, and just travel with a gazillion little file cards or whatever.
Yeah.
I think the musicians often get off really easy in that way.
Yeah. And, you know, it means that there are callers who love adding to the repertoire and writing new dances and are very prolific, but then that can accidentally mean that the ones who don't do that they fall out of favor, or they slowly disappear. That style of calling.
Yeah.
Where you just have a bunch of dances in right. your head and you don't need a box of cards and your dances yeah. aren't as complex.
Right. Yeah. When people started including chestnuts again, was a great thing. Or trying to have evenings that were all chestnuts, which is a commercial disaster. Like, how many people want to do that? Not very many. Just at Ralph Page once a year, maybe, but you know, so one or two chestnuts, like your chorus jig, like, okay, you have an evening of a really nice evening of variety pack, you know, of some old favorites, some new favorites, try to keep everybody happy. And then you throw chorus jig in there. Well, that's fine. It's sort of like on the same level as you get to do one square. Okay. That's right. Fine. You know, a few people are like grumbly about, you know, ever doing any square dance, even if it was the coolest square dance in the world, or even if it was being called by the coolest caller in the world. You know, they're just like, whatever, dude. You know, it's tough, you know, tough luck. We're going to like waste 8 minutes of you. That's 8 minutes of your life you're never going to get back while we do the square dance.
That's right. Too just bad.
Go, you know, talk to, yeah, go out and, you know, sit on the porch or something, talk to somebody. But for us, it's like a chance to really, you know, like stretch our legs a little bit. But now it's kind of like it's a little bit almost expected, right? Some places anyway. So now it's like the epitome of that is Money Musk, right? Okay. Mm-hmm. So if you get in a certain situation, the same people who are the cool hip dancers wanting to do the cool hip dances with their cool hip friends to the cool hip band or something, you know, there's this little bird in their brain. It says, chirps out Money Musk, and there's like, Money Musk. Well, I'm not putting them down. It's great. It's like, I love Money Musk too, but it's almost like a formulaic kind of thing. And I'd prefer that it was a little less like, you know, expected and maybe it will be. Maybe that's one way that people will be able to move forward is like, okay, we've had that experience. Like, what other cool dances are out there besides Chorus Jig and Money Musk that we might also enjoy? People have heard of Rory O'Moore because, and Petronella because, you know, adopted the signature figure for those things.
Right.
But what about, like, why don't we do, you know, Rory O'Moore? Huh? Oh, sure. Okay. Yeah.
I think there's, like, especially when these dances disappear or they begin to disappear, at first you just want to bring them back, and then there's a buzz to bringing them back. And then they can kind of settle back into some kind of normalcy, maybe, and other ones can start to kind
of,
that's what we're getting at.
Yeah. Right. I hope I qualified that whole Money Musk thing well enough. It's like people aren't going to be like, you know, Pete, get over it. Money Musk. It's classic.
It is classic. So. It's awesome.
Yeah.
I mean, it's exhilarating. I love
it. I've been part of the Money Musk flash mobs, you know. I played Money Musk solo with no backup for 10 minutes. I played it with the posse at Ralph Page for 18 minutes or whatever, you know. It goes out there with a posseization of it that we all changed instruments 3 times and people loved it. What else? I was Bob McQuillan's fiddler at an earlier Ralph Page many years ago playing Money Musk on Saturday night. You know, I've seen Money Musk from every angle, you know. I love it.
And there's also room in the tradition for other future Money Musks to be.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess that's my point.
Well, this has been so much fun. Thank you so much. It's really
nice to talk with you. For me too. I can't think of a better way to spend time here.
Thanks for listening to ContraPulse. This project is supported by CDSS, the Country Dance and Song Society, and is produced by Ben Williams. Thanks to Great Meadow Music for the use of tunes from the album Old New England by Bob McQuillan, Jane Orzechowski, and Deanna Stiles. Visit ContraPulse.cdss.org for more info. Happy dancing!